Hello, good evening, and welcome to Seascapes. On tonight's programme, do we have too many seals in the southwest of Ireland? And a trip to one of the country's most mysterious and mythical islands. Fishermen along the Kerry coast have been calling for a legal cull of the local seal population for some months now. They say that seal numbers have grown exponentially in recent years, and this increase is seeing more seals do extensive damage to their catch, their nets and other equipment. Grey and common seals are protected under EU directives, and the Great Plaskett Island is a special area of conservation for seals. Noel Sweeney met some fishermen as well as an animal rights activist from the area to discuss the matter for Seascapes.
The grey and common seals are classed as protected species under the Irish Wildlife Act 1976. Official estimates say that there are around 5,000 grey seals in Irish waters, but these fishermen from Dingle say that they are seeing more and more seals in local waters and that they are causing massive damage to their catch and are calling for a seal management plan.
My name is Ronan O'Sullivan.
And you're a gillnet fisherman?
Yeah, we're purposely rigged for gillnets. We don't fish in when the tides are strong, the net doesn't stand, so we don't fish the tides. We're very limited to the amount of days we get in between weather and tides, and then when we do get out, we always seem to have the problem of the seals.
Is it a large population of seals attacking the fish?
It's a massive population. Year on year we've just seen it increasing and increasing and increasing. There is no inshore pollock fishing here at the moment. We were saying it for years, with the last 10 years, that it was coming to this unless something would be done, and now it has happened. There, in the whole harbour here, there isn't one single gillnetting boat that's fishing inshore. All these boats, we ourselves had to turn to hake fishing. So now we're, instead of fishing where we'd be fishing in 30, 40 metres, 20 metres of water, now we're fishing up to 160, 170 metres, trying to avoid the seals.
Did you try attaching pingers onto the gillnets?
There was a survey done I think it was 2016 on the acoustic deterrents. It was a local vessel here that did it. Worked, I think, for the first day or something, the skipper was telling me, and after that, as it continued, it seemed to increase the amount of seals around the vessel. They seemed to hear this underwater, that it was increasing, it was drawing them towards the vessel. It only seemed to make things worse.
How would you like to see the seal depredation dealt with?
A management plan put forward anyway. National Parks and Wildlife, it's in their hands to put the management plan in place. We've asked them several times, we've had meetings with them, and it has come to nothing.
Have you any other means of diversifying your business?
Other boats here have diversified into potting. I can't see room for diversifying, putting more pressure on the stocks that are already being fished. I think there has to be a level playing field towards what's been taken out between every species. Speaking to other fishing boats up north of us, speaking to other vessels south of us, every skipper is telling us the same as what we're seeing, the spur dogs. Funnily enough, the seals don't affect the spur dogs. They don't seem to damage them in any way or eat them or anything. And this fishery, we're not allowed to take anything out of this fishery at the moment. It's a closed fishery for the last, I think it's 10 years or something. Since 2006, I think it's been closed. It's a closed fishery. We're seeing an awful amount of them on the ground. This is a fishery we can diversify to.
My name is Paul Hend.
What kind of fish do you catch normally?
Pollock, mainly, yeah. Mainly pollock.
Is there a big market for that?
Well, there is if you can catch it. Mm-hmm. That's the long and the short of it, but at the moment you can catch it because of the seals, like, you know. I mean, even the hook and line, they're taking the traces. They're taking all the hooks, 8-9 hooks each time before it comes to the surface at all.
How do they take the hooks?
The fish are on the hooks, and when they pull the fish, it breaks the line and takes the whole lot and the lid. That's 15 euros a trace for 4 machines. And they just keep taking them constantly, take anything up to 30 traces a day.
I believe a lot of fishermen these days, lobster fishermen as well, they've witnessed seals actually opening up their lobster pots.
That's right.
How does that happen?
It's happening in Dan Island, isn't it? They open the latch on the pot while you open it yourself, you see, and stick in their head and pull out the bait bag, the bait that's in the pot. That's it, then you have to repair the pot, and the pot isn't fishing until you repair it again.
What kind of seal management procedures would you like to see in place?
Well, they'll have to control them. They'll have to control them somehow. I don't know how they're going to go about it, but they're definitely going to have to control it. Because as we are standing here now, the seals are eating. And they'll be eating tonight, and they'll be eating tomorrow. And there'll be 10 or 20 of them outside the harbour waiting for you the minute you rip the ropes and go out, and they'll follow you for the day. And there's another 4,000 or 5,000 on the Blaskets to take their place. That's only on the Blasket Strand.
And those fish are completely useless then once they've been interfered with by seal?
No good. At the best of times, you're only coming ahead. That's all you're getting. And see, that's the problem. Most people haven't a clue what's going on. They think it's overfishing and all this. It's not overfishing when you can't catch fish, you know? You can catch them.
Ted Cronin of the newly formed Party for Animal Welfare says a management plan will do nothing to prevent seals from doing any further damage.
I am deputy leader for Party for Animal Welfare. We were founded about this time last year. Our main aim is to stop cruelty of animals in Ireland and to ban all blood sports.
Would you consider fishing itself to be blood sport?
Well, it was any killing of animals we would be against because of environmental issues. And scientists have proved that, you know, the best way of improving the environment is to stop killing animals, and that would include fish. And I sympathise with fishermen if they are losing stock or maybe jobs are at threat. But I think there's other ways we can look at instead of culling seals.
Fishermen say that they're not trying to stop seals eating fish at all, but more that they'd like to be able to stop the seals eating the fish that they've already caught.
Yeah, and I suppose seals eat fish. You know, the sea belongs to the seals. And yes, it's true that once the fish are in the nets, the seals are attacking the nets. But I suppose fishermen have to look at how they haul in, maybe faster hauling of the nets.
One of the points that they've been making is they're not hauling in, they can't seem to haul in the fish quick enough.
There's noise devices that deter seals from damaging fishermen nets.
We're talking about the sonar technology.
Yeah, acoustic deterrent devices.
In 2012, breeding females' growth was around 83%. Around the Blaskets and around Inishturk, it was as high as 96%. There's speculation now that those numbers are up on 400%. Most fishermen say that they've seen nothing like this before. What do you say to, you know, fishermen who will say that the only answer really is to cull the population?
I can't see what difference killing 60 or 100 seals is going to make. It's not like the rest of the seals are going to stop attacking or taking the fish, because it's a criminal act to kill a seal, because they are a protected species. Recently they've called for a cull again, and they've got politicians behind them.
Can you see where the fishermen are coming from, I suppose, you know, given like that they're not making a viable income many days because of this?
I do, of course, but it was many industries are in the same boat. And we have to make changes. You know, we have to look at our environment, our seas being overfished. But again, I go back to the point, what's the point in killing 60 to 100 seals? Is that going to stop the seals attacking the nets? It's not.
Noel Sweeney in Dingle. Irish inventors have been to the forefront in the technology in the maritime sector for many years. Going back through history, there are some notable names, and Hugh Orme, a regular contributor, has been looking at them.
Constant invention and the maritime industry go hand in hand and have done for centuries, as seafarers have sought to sail in faster but safer ships. While improvements have been continuous over the past 100 years, the great age for maritime invention was the 19th century, when many Irish inventors created many developments that revolutionised shipbuilding and shipping throughout the world. The first major Irish advance in the 19th century came in 1805 when an Irish hydrographer called Francis Beaufort developed the Beaufort scale, which was designed to classify wind speeds at sea. All important in the days when all ships were made from wood and dependent on wind strength to a vital degree. On the Beaufort scale, the starting point is zero, when the sea is so calm that it's like a mirror, a rare enough occurrence, right up to the top of the scale at 12, which represents devastating hurricane conditions. It took another 60 years for the next big maritime invention to be put in place in 1865, when the first successful transatlantic telegraph cable, 4,300 kilometres of cable, was laid on the Atlantic seabed, coming ashore in County Kerry. This cable was so successful that it led to a huge growth in transatlantic trade between Ireland and other European countries and America. And this huge expansion in transatlantic trade brought many obvious benefits to the shipping industry. Then in 1874 came yet another Irish invention, the Brennan torpedo. Louis Brennan came from Castlebar, County Mayo, but at an early age he emigrated to America, where he developed a wire-controlled torpedo. Different speeds on the wires connected to the shore station enabled the torpedo to hit its target up to 1,800 metres away at speeds of up to 27 knots. The torpedo became standard equipment for harbours all over the world, especially in the then mighty British Empire, as far away as Hong Kong. Manufacture of the Brennan torpedo lasted for over 15 years until its use stopped in 1906. At Fort Camden in Cork Harbour, you can still see most of the shore installation, although by now it's long since been derelict. And the only Brennan torpedo that actually survives can be seen in the Engineering Museum at Chatham in Kent in England. Yet another Irish maritime invention of huge significance came at about the same time when another Irish inventor, John Philip Holland, who was a schoolteacher from Liscannor, County Clare, completely changed the nature of warfare at sea when he invented the submarine. He emigrated to Boston, but his first prototype sank as soon as it was launched. But by 1881, he had launched a submarine called the Fenian Ram, which was far more successful, so much so that the US Navy started to buy them and develop the art of submarine warfare very successfully. Japan, as well as the UK, also bought a submarine. Another Irish maritime invention of huge significance in the late 19th century was the invention of Charles Parsons, whose origins were in County Offaly, of the steam turbine, which totally revolutionised motive power for ships. By the end of the 19th century, it was coming into widespread use for both passenger and freight ships, completely transforming motive power for the shipping industry. Some of his original turbines can still be seen at a museum in Newcastle-upon-Tyne in the northeast of England. There are few relics left of all these Irish-designed maritime inventions, but in Dublin you can still see one curious example, the diving bell that was used for many years in Dublin Port. Wars always created the need for new technology, and this is exactly what happened during the First World War. Steel for shipbuilding was in very short supply, so in 1917 the shipyard at Warren Point in County Down began building concrete ships, some of which were ocean-going tugs. But the experiment didn't really work, and you can still see the remains of one of those concrete ships beached on the River Moy just downstream from Ballinar in County Mayo. Since the end of the First World War, innovation has been a continued feature of Irish ship design, with many improvements to the way in which hulls are built and the way in which ships are fitted out, including navigational aids. But all the many advances in 20th century ship design can be seen in such modern creations as the new ship for the Irish Navy, the L.E. William Butler Yeats, commissioned at Galway Docks in 2016. and such is their long-standing Irish interest in ship design, that the chances are that the next big advance, whatever it is, will be a work once more of an Irish designer.
Hugh Orr. Recently on the programme, I spoke to Philip Marsden about his beautiful book, The Summer Isles. It's his exploration by sea of many of the islands off the west coast. One of those we spoke about was Inishglora, the last resting place of the Children of Lear. It's a notoriously difficult island to gain access to, but Joanna McNicholas has been there.
If you're a lover of the great outdoors, are a regular listener to this programme, then you might know the joy of a day trip to an Irish offshore island, especially if it's a warm and sunny day. Back in the 1990s, a group of friends and I began visiting islands off the west coast of Ireland. We wanted to explore these ancient gems which are scattered along our western coastline. Each year, we would travel to islands which could be located anywhere between Rathlin off County Antrim in the north to as far south as Skellig-Michael off County Kerry. Now, those were the days before the internet. And back then, the simple and uncomplicated way to arrange a trip to an island was to telephone the post office nearest to our destination and ask if they knew anyone in the area who did boat trips. We would be given the name and telephone number of a boatman nearby who could help us. This would be a local fisherman who operated a boat for hire. And following a phone call, arrangements would be made. Normally, we would be dropped off at the chosen island, and then our boatman would sail off and do some fishing and return later to collect us. There was one island that our group was very eager to visit. The Isle of Inishglora. This mysterious island off Belmullet in West Mayo is famous for its link with the mythical legend of the Children of Lir. And after some research, we identified Blacksod Pier as our port of departure for Inishglora. As arrangements were being made, we were warned that landing on the island would be challenging. It's well known that very few people visit Inishglora, and of those who attempted, very few managed to land on the island. In the whole of an Irish summer, there's usually only one or maybe 2 days when the sea is calm enough to gain access to this mysterious island. The fishermen told us that we would have to wait patiently until the right conditions presented themselves. And then there might be a chance that we would gain access to the island. Finally, the weather was looking favourable for our crossing, and while it wasn't definite, there was a good possibility we might be able to land on the island. Filled with excitement and a bit of trepidation, we boarded our boat at Blacksod Pier, rounded the headland and sailed northwards, travelling parallel to the Mullet Peninsula on the Mayo mainland. Blacksod Bay opens out into the broad Atlantic Ocean, and the area is dotted with several small islands, including Dovalon, the Inish Cays, and far out on the horizon, the triangular silhouette of Blackrock. In later years, Blackrock Island would feature on our television screens for several weeks following the horrific helicopter crash of Rescue 116, which took place in the early hours of the 14th of March in 2017. It claimed the lives of 4 of our most experienced Irish Coast Guard crew. On that day, our destination was Inishglora, a small island just a few miles away. And this holy isle is approximately 1 mile long by a half a mile wide, and it is surrounded by gigantic teeth-like rocks which guard it viciously. The island has no pier, but there are one or two areas where a curragh can safely land, but only if the sea is extremely calm. This requires a skilled boatman, But of course, it also requires the visitor's brave act of climbing out of the fishing vessel and into a curragh while on the sea. And for those unfamiliar with the practice, there's nothing to test courage and tenacity like hanging off a wobbly boat while attempting to get your foot into a wobbly curragh, all the while knowing there's hundreds of feet of Atlantic Ocean just beneath you. The trip to Inishglora took about an hour, and on that day conditions were very good. The ocean was extremely calm, and as we approached the island, our boatman anchored and we carefully unloaded into the curragh. We were sailing on faith alone, just like the early monks who travelled these waters long, long ago. With all passengers safely on board the curragh, we were rowed across and dropped off on a small area of white sand surrounded by pale pink rocks. The most extraordinary thing about Inishglora is the place it holds in Irish mythology. And my first impression of the island was the atmosphere of peace which filled the air. This tiny island saw the culmination of the tragic Irish legend of the four children of King Lear, who were transformed into swans for 900 years by their jealous stepmother. They were banished to live 300 years on the waters of Loch Derivara, north of Mullingar, 300 years off Rathlin Island in County Antrim, and their final 300 years were spent on the waters around Belmullet. When Finola and her brothers, A. Conan Fiacre, landed on Inishglora and heard St. Patrick's bell, we are told that the spell was broken and they were returned to human form. The island has been uninhabited now for several decades, with only ruins left to fill our minds with curiosity about the people who once lived just yards from the Atlantic shore. Inishglora is long and flat and contains remnants of a monastic settlement, an ancient church and beehive huts. And alongside the chapel ruins are a group of flagstones, reputedly the graves of the children of Lear. It is difficult to visit Inishglora and not be touched by this ancient legend, which has been carried forward for thousands of years here in Ireland. On our trips to remote islands, our group always bring a picnic, and we are happily rewarded when we find a comfortable rock to sit on, to share a cup of tea and a sandwich in the company of seagulls, crashing waves and tranquility. And after a couple of hours on Inishglora, our boatman called back to collect us. And on the journey back to Blacksod, we had time to reflect on this early Irish settlement and the difficulties which must have been experienced by the resilient people who long ago called Inishglora their home. Over the years, on several occasions, we have attempted to revisit Inishglora, but we haven't always been successful. Sometimes the island isn't very welcoming, but when it does open its doors to visitors, it is indeed a privilege to spend a while on this sacred Irish island, to experience its calm and peace, and if nothing else, just to reflect on the ancient tragic legend of the children of Lear.
Joanna McNicholas. And Philip Marsden's book, The Summer Isles, is published by Granta, and you can now also find it on Kindle. Another island Philip mentions is High Island, which was once owned by the poet Richard Murphy. He wrote a lot of poetry about it, but one in particular, called High Island. We've in fact played it on the programme before, but in these difficult times, I think it can take us away to another, more magical place.
This poem, which I call High Island, begins with a distant view of the island, and it gets closer and closer into the heart of it, the bird life, the monastic calm. A shoulder of rock sticks high up out of the sea, a fisherman's mark for lobster and blue shark. Fissile and stark, The crust is flaking off. Seal Rock, Gull Rock, Cove and Cliff. Dark mounds of mica schist. A lake, mill and chapel. Roofless, one gable smashed, lie ringed with rubble. An older calm, the kiss of rock and grass. Pink thrift and white sea campion, flowers in the dead place. Day keeps lit a flare round the North Pole all night. Like brushing long wavy hair, petrels quiver in flight. Quietly as the rustle of an arm entering a sleeve, they slip down to nest under altar stone or grave. Round the wrecked Laura, needles flicker, tacking air quicker and quicker to rock, sea and star.
That's it for Seascapes. We're back at the same time next Friday.